Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we're back for Monday, and I don't know about you guys, but after 4 years and three quarters, I still can't get used to this new opening song. I gotta find a new one, but that's another conversation for another time. Jeff, Henry, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
Good. Good, good, good.
Good. That's good.
We're all doing good. We're all doing fine. Before we get down to brass tacks, we need to talk about something very important, fellas. We can't allow our listeners to make a mistake because chances are they're listening to this tomorrow morning on the way to work. And they forgot. They haven't checked their calendars. They didn't set a reminder. No one dropped any hints. As you're listening to this, it's Valentine's Day. So you better detour to the Walgreens, the Walmart, the Publix, the Piggly Wiggly, wherever you pick up your current Valentine's Day or birthday cards and get yourself a card. Don't get the don't get that waxy ash chocolate. Your lady doesn't want that. No. Hopefully you planned ahead, but if you didn't, better scramble at lunch. Make a detour on the way home. Because heaven forbid, if you show up at the house with nothing, nada, empty hands, nothing but a smile, you're going to get a very cold dinner and a bad look on her face. So just our little helpful hint from me, Jeff and Henry, to all of you guys listening, driving to work.
I think we've been married long. I mean, I've been married long enough to certainly know that, and I'm sure you guys have too.
We got a lot of young listeners, though. I'm reaching out to our community. We're trying to do a community service here. All you young
if
cats.
You okay, if you're getting your Valentine at a Piggly Wiggly, it's already done. It's over.
That doesn't. That doesn't fly. Hey, that doesn't fly. There's a bar.
Hey,
you know, there's a bar that has to be met. And now, what Jeff just said does not meet that bar.
But Jeff is out of the three of us. Jeff lives the closest to the middle of nowhere. But I'm assuming we have listeners who live even further in the middle of nowhere. And besides, who are we to judge people's taste? I once saw a man propose to his old lady in the fire lane of Walmart in North Fort Myers. Who am I to judge? She was happy. She was thrilled. So, hey, maybe you know a secret. Maybe there's a nice, I don't know, does Piggly Wiggly even sell like a cheesecake or a French silk pie? Maybe you can get a late pumpkin pie or a nice Dutch apple pie. But I don't think she'd be happy you came home with a card and a Dutch apple pie either. But you never know. It's each their own. So as you're starting your day listening to this podcast, just you got a few more hours to figure something out in the last minute.
Thanks for upping the tension level on that too, by the way. That's great.
Yeah. Just gotta put that out there, a little beacon from us to you guys, a little radio, a little SOS, a little dot dot dash dash and all that good stuff. But anyhow, fellas, how are you all doing? What's new in your all's world?
I got my Valentine taken care of, man. I mean, you know, with our schedules, a Valentine's Day on a Tuesday.
Isn't that romantic? Nothing spells romance like a Tuesday.
Yeah, so
at least it was on at least if it was on a Wednesday, there'd be jokes to be made. Oh, it's hump day, but no, it's really a Tuesday.
Yeah, we had our fun on Saturday night and got her what she wanted, and then something else that I didn't even know she wanted that just kind of fell in our lap, a puppy.
Oh, ooh, we like the dogs.
What kind of puppy you got?
All right, so well, we friends of ours, former Marine actually lives around here. They've got Aussie Shepherds,
mm-hmm.
and Basset Hounds,
oh.
and Mom and Dad are registered, you know, AKC. And he said, "Look, man, I thought this was going to be the ugliest dog in the world.
Oh, no,
it's literally the complete opposite. Okay, this is literally the cutest puppy ever.
So you
ever
have
that existed.
You got a dog that." Ears turn off when its nose turns on, but it's very loyal and likes to herd things.
Pretty much, yeah. It's gonna be, and well, it's a mini. It's a miniature Aussie, and I guess it's technically not even Aussie; it's an American.
Well, he's gonna Aussie. Be miniature if he's part Basset, anyhow. So
he's gonna have He's gonna have a thick undercarriage if he's got Basset in him.
Right, but that's the thing, that the coat stays a lot shorter. They're not like tripping and eating their own ear kind of thing. It's a neat looking dog. Really beautiful colors and what she wanted.
Why do we not hear him? What's his name?
Well, so he's only 4 weeks.
Okay, so you don't have
layaway.
Yeah, he came over with four of them. We got to pick which one.
He's gonna
deliver two more weeks. So, but we just called him Moose, and it stuck. Because he just looks like he's gonna be big, fat, lazy.
Well, see, I'm glad you brought that up because Don's just wearing it out with Jasper and Bailey, and my wife's loving all that, and I'm commenting on it and loving it. So I'm like, man, I know where Don stands on dogs. I know I love dogs more than people, so it's nice to know that Jeff has joined the fray.
You know, I've always had a dog. I just
know that.
He just keeps it close to the vest.
I'm terrible with like any kind of social media, or actually like portray like what I'm trying to tell people and what they're seeing in pictures and like the message they're trying to. It's just discombobulated for me. Like I just show pictures like, hey, guess what? I have a kid that turned four today or whatever. Like, oh, you have kids? Yeah. I'm not good with that. I'm terrible. So it is what it is.
You know, the irony is I'm such a dog lover that hypothetically I should be terrified of them. I don't know if I've ever told this story here. So when I was growing up and we had our defunct farmhouse in Kentucky, which is now nothing but a White Castle, two pilot truck stops, and a defunct Holiday Inn. Thanks, Nan Ann, for selling the property. But anywho, I was coming home from school one day, and there was a Malamute tied to our tree in our front yard. Mom must have got a new dog. Wasn't a rare occasion. My grandmother bred German Shepherds and Pekingese, and my aunt used to show and breed Shepherds, and so I come from a family of dogs. And my sister's petting this Malamute, and I pet it, and a son of a bitch jumps on my head and jumps on me and tears my head open. Luckily, he was on a leash. My brother hit it with the pole from the clothesline, drug me out of the radius of the chain. My mom was like four cars behind the school bus heading home. It was Kentucky, middle of October. To this day, I can remember freezing my ass off because my mom sprayed me down with a water hose to see where I was bleeding from. And I was only in kindergarten, maybe first grade, and I can still remember laying on the gurney getting staples in my head. I had like 63 staples in my head. This damn dog damn near killed me.
Jeez.
And you would think someone who lived through that, I love damn dogs. Don't know what it is, but did not scare me off of them one bit.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
But yeah, that's enough hot dog talk on the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. We're going to get down to brass tacks. Do you want to get to the subject? Do you want to go to that? Should we do a little early mail call real quick to get that out of the way so we don't forget?
I vote mail call, Henry.
Let's do an early mail call.
Yeah, do the mail call, man. Yeah. Read the email.
And while Jeff cleans his palate, we're going to say we do want to hear from you. So if you have any comments, suggestions, critiques, or whatnots, email us at mailcall@wtspworldwar2.com, and your words will come through Jeff's mouth in such eloquent way. And those ways are ready to go. Here he goes with this week's mail call.
Oh, I'm reading it. I wasn't prepared for that. Okay, so this comes from DJ in Charleston, South Carolina. Hello, gentlemen. Thoroughly enjoyed the podcast. I enjoy listening to the new episodes when they drop. Love to watch on YouTube, but I'm going to bed around the time of the show, so I just enjoy while I'm working. It helps me get through the day and is always so entertaining. I especially like when you share the books you are reading, which is the What You're Reading segment, right, Don? I'm a big-time reader. When I have free time, it's what I love to do. All I read is World War II history, mostly, and for the most part, it's PTO, but not exclusively. So when you share books, it's right up my alley. Wasn't sure if any of you fellas, I think it's supposed to say use Goodreads.
Correct.
I keep track of all I have read, but I want to read and what I'm currently reading. If you have one, I'd love to follow you so I can see what you all have read for new ideas. I'm always on the hunt for my next read. Also, I know you have been reading Big Week and Wing and a Prayer, not about the air war. Well, I just finished up Brave Men by Ernie Pyle. There was a passage when he was talking about being bombed by our own heavy bombers as the U.S. was launching the breakout of Normandy. And the planes being hit by flak. Thought it was worth sharing. If you haven't read the book, it's wonderful. Pyle was a gifted writer, correspondent, and died doing what he loved on Okinawa. Here's the excerpt below. Sorry if it's long, but it's so worth the read. Take care, DJ from Charleston, South Carolina.
Nice.
Interesting that he mentions Okinawa. What a perfect segue, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, our listeners may or may not probably realize how not so organized we are sometimes. And hey, what are we gonna do? I don't know. We'll figure it out. Okay, let's do it. And it always comes out great.
Yeah, it does.
It does. Sometimes it's better that way.
Well,
right?
And that's how you know we're not like phoning this in, or not like lifting material from other podcasts or anything, because, you know, we don't do any real show prep. I'm in here like an hour before the show starts just pull clips and whatnot. But other than that, we fly by the seat of our britches around here.
Yeah, I think we do it well. So in preparation for tonight's episode, I came across a story that I'm so excited because it's so brand new and it's fresh, and I just can't wait to share it with everybody. And it's got a little bit of a neat backstory. So months ago, and I may have shared this with our listeners, the library, anytime they have books that they're just doing away with, they kind of let me go through the trash before it goes out.
It's a nice problem to have.
It's pretty cool. And there were three old books. And she said, look, I don't know what you'd want to do with them. This is the library director. She said, it's not going to offend me if you don't want them, but we thought of you when we saw them. And she said, you know, if you want to take a look. So let me grab it. This is the 1928 The Longhorn. Now, for us today, that probably sounds like a strange name for a yearbook out of Texas A&M. Of course, the Longhorn, as we know from the University of Texas, a big rival. But the Longhorn was the name of the yearbook
now,
up until about 1946.
For you guys listening to the audio version of this, Jeff's holding up this book, big-ass book, that almost looks like the book from Army of Darkness. I don't know if that's rawhide on the cover of that thing. It looks like it's bound in flesh. I mean, it's a huge book.
But they're beautiful. They're beautiful. Yes. So the reason they were called the Longhorn, so they started in 1903 calling it the Longhorn, and it was to kind of, I guess, pay homage to the Longhorn State. This is before we were known as the Lone Star State. It was the Longhorn State. So that only made sense. And I think it's really interesting when you first open it up, there's a little message that says they will soon pass away, those dreamy college days, with a nice illustration here. And there's some color in here. And I just thought that's interesting, those dreamy college days, because we probably think, oh gosh, how fast the world turns today. Oh, how time flies. And even, I'm sure, not that long ago, in 1928, that was not a new thing either, to think that, oh man, these dreamy college days will soon pass away and we'll be off to the world. So I thought that was an interesting connection. So there is a colleague of mine that teaches here at the high school. There's a few that are proud graduates of Texas A&M, and one of them happens to be a teacher of my son. And I flipped through this book, and I saw that there were pictures of – there was a lot of girls in here, which I thought was strange coming from an all-male school. And so she goes, oh, but there can't be girls in there. So I said, well, I figured I'd go ahead and bring it to school one day. And
can I guess?
Let her take a look. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead and guess.
Was there a sister school and they merged the two to save money on pressing of yearbooks?
I think that was actually what she had said as well. The best we can guess, these are sweethearts.
Oh.
Assuming from the senior class.
I gotcha.
And, yeah, and there was also a Duchess of the Cotton Palace, kind of a local deal here, the A&M Duchess to the Cotton Palace. So here's, I know for our audio listeners, this isn't going to do much, but if you're watching,
she's
what
the
a great photo,
is.
Right?
Let me ask you this, as somebody who's working in education, and probably will have a few yearbook photos taken of yourself, do you see the template of the modern day yearbook as you're looking through that, or was it substantially different in 1928 versus today? The layout, the format of it? Because, I mean, yearbooks tend to have kind of a template.
Yeah. No, I think very similar. You go through all the faculty and everything, and then you go through the senior classes. Now, what's interesting is they sometimes will show you where they're from. If they're not a native-born citizen, they may say that, you know, Korea or something like that. But for the most part, just guys in uniform, what their major is, their age, their rank, of course, because, you know, at this time, if you were in the Corps here, you were in the military. To get too far off on that.
Well,
I don't want to get too far off on that.
Well, I, you know me, I love a good rabbit hole. Just think, though, that faculty that you're looking at, the ones who are in their 40s, they're born in 1888.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Just the history that those guys saw.
Right. And so thinking if these guys graduated in 1928, most of them were 23, 24, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at what? These guys are about 40 during the war. These are potentially your light colonels, your full birds, your brigadiers, one-star generals during World War II. So interesting. And for those who don't know much about Texas A&M and its history, it really is a special school. And if you know anything about the history of this, how they served the country, World War I and World War II, you should really look into it because, yeah, it's about 2 hours from where I'm at. I've had the opportunity to go up there. I was asked to speak at one of the classes there, which was really cool. This was years ago, and got to watch A&M whoop up on Iowa State at the old Kyle Field and just experience everything that is Texas A&M. It was really moving. So, moving forward, after I let my colleague kind of look through and she kind of helped, you know, translate some of this for me, being an Aggie, she had mentioned that she had two relatives that served in World War II. One was from her mom's side, one was from her dad's side. And the interesting thing is these guys were buddies and served on the island of Okinawa together. So I want to share a little bit, just kind of wanted to spotlight, and I have her permission and the permission from her family. I just wanted to kind of spotlight this particular veteran, and you know, by the time this hits our website, there will be a picture of the veteran as well.
And real quick, just because Jeff's audio cut out for you guys listening, he said the island of Okinawa. When you said Okinawa, it cut out, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Was I being censored?
Uh-oh. No, you're
no,
you're,
it just yeah,
you,
the feed
you dropped out just for that
out.
One word. So I just wanted for oh, what gosh. Island did he
okay.
say?
Oh no, yes, Okinawa. So so this, her maternal great uncle is who we're really kind of paying respects to. And I want to keep his history alive. His name was Sergeant Cecil Holycamp. He attended Texas A&M University, and he enlisted following Pearl Harbor, along with most of the cadets and students on campus. He was a member of the 96th Infantry, the Deadeyes, in the 383rd Infantry Regiment, Company K. He was killed in action in April of 1945 during the Battle of Okinawa. And he said, according to her grandfather, her great-grandfather, it was by a sniper. The interesting thing here is his GI Bill was used by his family to rebuild Trinity Episcopal Church in Junction, Texas. Now, that right there I thought was really unique because, you know, a lot of times we say, oh, he bought the farm,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's where the saying comes from.
That's where the saying comes from, right? A lot of times, and we may have said this before, where, you know, the GI Bill went to the family and they literally would pay off the farm or any debts with what they got from the, you know, losing their son. So the fact that his GI Bill was used to rebuild this church in Junction, Texas was really kind of impressive to me. I've never heard of that before. I thought that was really interesting. So her paternal grandfather, Sergeant William Allen, was best friends with Cecil. So from her mom's side, Cecil, and from her dad's side, this William Allen, they were best friends. They both attended A&M. They enlisted together. They were classmates in Aggieland. And this guy was also a member of the 96th Infantry, but he served in the 381st, where her great-uncle served in the 383rd. He was awarded three Purple Hearts. And he had shrapnel in his brain until he died, and he was terrified of x-rays. He never talked about combat, and he dealt with a good deal of wrath from Cecil's mother since he came back without Cecil. He did tell his grandmother, though, that he recited the 100th Psalm in foxholes as a means of coping, and that he promised God that if he survived the war, he would never leave the ranch. With the exception of visiting granddaughters in Dallas, he kept that promise. And he told me, this being my colleague, that my grandmother saved his life. Now, the interesting thing about this, a little Cecil Holycamp, you can find him, and he comes up. He was awarded the Bronze Star for bravery at Leyte, and he was a machine gun section sergeant on Okinawa. And he is briefly, but he is mentioned in a book, Texas, I want to say it was the Texas Aggies at War, where, and they kind of go through all of the fighting Texas Aggies that I'm assuming all that were killed in action. That's all I could see as I was cruising through. But the section about Sergeant Cecil Holycamp was that he was leading his machine gun section on the morning of 9 April, 1945 at Cockasoo Ridge when he was killed in action. And it was his buddies wrote home that he was a good guy. He was a good friend. And that was what was written home to his family. So again, I included a picture. She was nice enough to share a picture of Sergeant Cecil Holycamp. And he was also featured in the newspaper, of course, when it came out that he was killed in action on Okinawa. But all of a sudden, this really kind of became a little bit personal because, again, this is just somebody I work with. This is an educator that, you know, that works at the same high school as me and teaches my son. And she also mentioned, of course, Aggies, when they graduate, of course, they get a ring. And she had recovered her Billy Allen's. He's the one who survived the Battle of Okinawa. She had his ring that was very dirty when she had found it or when she had gotten it. And it was, in her estimation, that dirt. She talked about digging foxholes in Okinawa. That was probably particles of Japanese soil that came home on that Aggie ring as well. So I thought that was very interesting. And to see just an obscure, you know, just a face with a name, a guy in uniform, just doing his job, leading his machine gun at Cockasoo Ridge at the beginning of what became the defensive perimeter on Shuri, the Shuri line, was just really interesting to me. And to think that these two buddies, one guy coming home, it's hard enough to come home, mm-hmm. right? I can't imagine it's got to be even harder when you come home, but your best friend doesn't. And, you were that close to be able to still stay in contact, you know, with the family. So really awesome. I really appreciate her sharing it with me and giving me the, giving me the permission to share it with all of you. And if you're not sure what the Shuri line is or what Cockasoo Ridge even means, I know that it was a meat grinder. They estimated 96th Infantry Division suffered 200% casualties, which is just unbelievable. And I think at this point, I'd kind of like for Henry to kind of fill in some gaps and really kind of paint the picture of what it was like from his perspective and his research on what it meant to be fighting in those early days of April in that particular part of Okinawa.
Sure, I can speak to that. I'd actually had looked up a couple passages here and with the old breed about when they got into Shuri, which was end of May. But let's adjust on the fly here. Cockasoo Ridge, I remember I have come across quite a bit of stuff where both published and unpublished where my dad talked about Cockasoo Ridge.
You want me to buy you a few seconds?
Yeah. Could you do that, please?
For those of you not familiar with the Okinawa campaign, I'm by far no means an expert, but I did refresh myself a little bit. And as we've spoken in the past, one of the things that worked towards us as a benefit being the people fighting the Japanese is the Japanese, they had a lot of infighting within their military structure. And one of those infightings was the Navy and the Army just – they decided to do their own things at all different times, and the other one had to play catch-up. And so when it came to Okinawa, the Navy thought, hey, this would be the perfect place to whittle down the Americans. Let's hold them off. Let's try to take out as many of them as we can before they attack our homeland, Japan. The Army said, not so much. We're pulling out most of our forces. So believe it or not, Okinawa was only defended roughly by a little over 100,000 men, but a good portion of those were basically Okinawan citizens who were forced into military service, anything between the ages of 18 to 40. And a lot of the death count that Jeff kind of talked about earlier and that Henry will get to momentarily, a lot of that was basically because of the geographical location, the island that was made up. The Japanese set up bunkers in the Okinawans' burial mausoleums. They had their way of remembering their dead was to put them in caves, and basically the Japanese took over those caves and entrenched guns there, and they basically had another thing that gets into this is we're all familiar with bonsai charges and kamikazes. Well, the whole Okinawa campaign from the Japanese was based off of kamikazes, the wind. Obviously, they had the kamikaze planes, which, by the way, at that point, most kamikaze pilots only had 3 weeks to a month and a half of training. They were basically just trained to take off and crash. They also had the bonsai charge. That was a big part of their infantry. And what I forgot and didn't realize is they actually had about 350 small boats packed full of explosives who were kamikaze boat crews. They were just to drive their little crafts out and try to blow up as many crafts as they could before they went out. And so it was a very hard-fought campaign. Casualties were high, once again, because of the fact that we were on the disadvantaged side of trying to perpetrate these natural caves, the horrible weather, etc. And hopefully Henry is ready to go.
I'm ready to go. So after that personal involvement, that personal story that Jeff just shared with us, let me just give a little historical context here. So this is reading from With the Old Breed. All right. The portion of when my dad was doing a little strategizing and explaining to contextualize everything once they were really starting to get going on Okinawa. Of primary importance to the defense of the island were three east-west ridge systems crossing the southern part of the island. To the north and just below the invasion beaches lay the ridges of Kakazu and Nishibaru. In the middle, running west from Shuri Castle, was the most formidable of the ridges, cut by sheer cliffs and deep draws. Above the extreme southern tip of the island lay Kanishi, Yuzudake, and Yezudake. Together, these ridges formed a series of natural defensive barriers to the American forces advancing from the north. Into these natural barriers, Lieutenant General Mitsuru Ushijima threw the bulk of his 110,000-man 32nd Japanese Army. Natural and man-made barriers were transformed into a network of mutually supporting positions linked by a system of protected tunnels. Each of the ridge lines was held in great strength until it became untenable. Then the enemy withdrew to the next defense line. Thus, the Japanese drew on their experiences at Peleliu, Saipan, and Iwo Jima to construct a highly sophisticated and powerful defense in depth. There they waited and fought to exhaust the will and the resources of the American 10th Army, of which the aforementioned 96th Infantry Division was part. And there's one little paragraph that I'll tack on to the end of this is later on, where my father talks about, he says, meanwhile, three army divisions were coming up short against fierce Japanese resistance in the Kakazu Nishibaru ridgeline, the first of three main enemy defense lines in the southern portion of the island. Stretched from left to right across Okinawa, the 7th, 96th, and 27th Infantry Divisions were getting more than they could handle and were making little progress in their attacks. And he's saying that in the context of they landed April Fool's Day, and for quite a bit of time in early April, it was almost like a holiday. It was so completely unexpected. The landing was unopposed. And it was just unexpectedly easy, but they knew that once they got down into the southern portion of the island of Okinawa, that the Japanese were not going to give it up cheap.
Yeah, because part of that strategy, like I said earlier, the Army pulled out a good portion of their men. And so the men they had left, they put a few up in the northern part of Okinawa kind of just to slow us down a little bit. But a majority of their crew was manning the Shuri line and then the southern end of the island so that they wouldn't get outflanked. And so, as Henry was saying, as we landed in the northern and the northeastern side, as we were coming down, it wasn't until we ran into this little groups of basically roadblocks, if you will, that we started facing some interference, and that kind of withered us down and slowed us down before we got to Shuri line, which things really, really got rough.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sure. And it's definitely, I think it's important. And like Henry said, with the Marines and Army landing, or maybe Don said, to try to coordinate that many divisions, that many men and three different branches of the military. I mean, what a logistical nightmare. And, the Marines, of course, first kind of securing that northern end of the island, were not nearly the defensive positions were more towards the south. So, of course, what was thought when the Army was hitting a brick wall, of course, the Marines were like, let's go save the day. So, yeah, I've got something here I wanted to share as well. It was a nice little write-up, just a little bit of a history of that fighting right around that time. As the Americans advanced, pushed further south, it read headlong into fortified Japanese positions and heavily defended caves near Kakasu Ridge, the first defensive perimeter, and what would be called the Shuri Line. The rapid advance and relatively light American casualties sustained so far on Okinawa ended. American commanders realized immediately that the Japanese had been withholding their strongest defensive efforts and had deployed them in an area in which the terrain favored the defenders. There would be no more lightning advances. In a period of just 24 hours, American casualties ashore nearly doubled. Okinawa was realized would become a bloody slugfest. The Army's 96th Infantry Division lay before Kakasu Ridge on the morning of April 8, 1945, and prepared to make an assault on the positions that had halted their initial advance. With no preparatory artillery barrage, the two companies of infantry jumped off from their positions before daybreak so as to achieve surprise. One company from the 96th, under the command of Lieutenant Willard Mitchell, reached the top of Kakasu Ridge before Mitchell and his men were pinned down by furious Japanese fire. The Americans were unable to dig in on the rough coral tops of Kakasu and thus were exposed to well-aimed rifle fire and shrapnel from all angles. The Japanese, knowing they had their enemy at their mercy, sprang from their caves, hurling grenades and satchel charges at the pinned down American infantry. The Japanese assault was halted with heavy losses. Mitchell's men repelled the Japanese assault in hand-to-hand combat with fixed bayonets and rifle butts. Now, this is 8 April, 1945. The very next day, 9 April, would be Sergeant Cecil Holecamp's last day. And I wanted to show, for those who are watching, this is the patch of the 96th Infantry Division, the Dead Eyes. So, really, really
cool. I've never seen that
story. Yeah. Yeah, it's a neat one. So again, thank you to the family for allowing me to share that, and Henry, really thanks for really going into an explanation and just knowing, your dad was there, right there with somebody that I run into being a relative of, just really kind of ties things a little bit closer for me and in the keeping history alive, so. And what a great mail call from our buddy in Charleston, South Carolina, talking about Okinawa. I thought that was great.
And Okinawa was, rough sledding. Not only, as we said, the fighting against the Japanese, but the mud, the living conditions, the rain. But as we said, a good portion of the military was conscripted Okinawans. And part of the way the Japanese got them to fight, other than do the horrible things which they were known for back then, is brainwashing and fanaticism. If anybody's done any reading or watched any specials on Okinawa, you know what happens once we started liberating villages and towns and areas, that the Okinawans were so brainwashed by the Japanese that they were told that the American Marines and American Army were cannibals and criminals and rapists and thieves. And so as we're trying to liberate And that's the other thing, too, is up until this point, there was very little. I mean, there were some, but not by no means this caliber of civilian areas. I mean, there's a lot of civilians involved. And as we saw portrayed in the episode on the Pacific, they're all held down at the bottom of that ravine, and these civilians are coming down. And we've all heard the stories about the grenades and the using them as bait, machine gun fire, and all that. The Japanese by no means had any real care for their fellow man, let alone the Okinawans. And so as we're liberating places, people like Henry's father and the gentleman Jeff's talking about, they're watching mothers throw their babies over and then jumping over cliffs because they were afraid that we were going to do horrible things to them after we liberated them. And so not only do you have to deal with what you saw in combat, but then you had to sit there and look at that at the end of the day. It's just a rough environment all the way around.
Yeah, for sure. And then, if I could jump in real quick and say this, if you're interested in hearing more about Okinawa, there's a great book by my friend Saul David called Pacific Crucible. And it is strictly about the Battle of Okinawa. It fairly recently written, too. It just came out in the last year and a half, maybe 2 years.
I can't remember the sergeant's name, sorry. But he had a relative. He fought in the Civil War for the South. And I've seen photos and I've read the article, but I can't remember the gentleman's name. When we actually captured Seary Castle, no one had an American flag available on him at that particular time. So while a person went back to find one, he actually pulled out a Confederate flag that he had in his haversack and flew it over Seary Castle for a short period of time, much like his great-grandfather would have done during the Civil War.
That's right here with the old breed. You want me to hit that paragraph?
Absolutely.
About mid-morning on 29 May, 3-5 attacked the Shuri with Company L in the lead and Companies K and I following closely. Earlier in the morning, Company A, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, had attacked eastward into the ruins of Shuri Castle and had raised the Confederate flag. When we learned that the flag of the Confederacy had been hoisted over the very heart and soul of Japanese resistance, all of us Southerners cheered loudly. The Yankees among us grumbled, and the Westerners didn't know what to do. Later, we learned that the stars and stripes that had flown over Guadalcanal were raised over Shuri Castle, a fitting tribute to the men of the 1st Marine Division who had the honor of being first into the Japanese citadel.
Jeff mentioned earlier that when the relatives got his Aggie ring, had the dirt and the mud on it. And my first thought was, you know, that shows you how much love they had for their state and their school, because as we know from watching many series, not all of them did, but a lot of guys wore the Marine Corps ring. And he opted to wear his Aggie ring. But the question I had for you, Henry, is, do you still have your father's ring, or was that a movie thing, or did he actually wear his ring through combat as portrayed in the miniseries?
That was a movie thing. I do have a ring back there in the back room, the gold Marine Corps ring that was his. He did wear it, but he didn't get it till after the war.
Gotcha.
So I got to be honest about that. Well, that whole thing with the ring, you'd think that I would know where that originated from, and I'm just really not sure, because they made a big deal about showing that like little signet ring that Joe Mazzello wore. And I don't think that my dad wore anything like that.
While we're on the subject of the show and true and false of Hollywood versus reality, what about the EGA on the lapel? Was that something him and Sid Phillips actually did?
Yeah, he did. He did. Because he says that there's not one on that dungaree jacket right there, but he did have one because he talked about it before hitting Peleliu.
That's a cool little artifact, though.
Since we had talked about Shuri Castle, this is a sake cup. I know our listeners can't really see it, but this is a sake cup that my dad picked up in the ruins of Shuri.
Wow. If you could take a nice clean photo of that, we'll put it up on the website so that the audio listeners can share. And same thing with your book, Jeff, if you could maybe take a picture of that cover and maybe just one or two of the pages. That way our audio listening people don't feel like they're missing out on anything.
That's a good point. And you know, you guys have seen all this, but this is the Japanese NCO samurai sword that he also picked up in the ruins of Shuri.
And so, how long do you think that thing is? 3.5, 4 feet?
Yeah, about that. 3, 4.
Now, I don't know the amount of time before they got picked up between the Battle of